living and working. Peter Coleman of Wilmington, Delaware, is going to speak about his childhood in Greece, his living and working conditions after immigrating to America, and why he came to Delaware.
Could you give us your name?
My name is Peter Coleman. I wasn't born with that name, but that's what my father adopted when I first came to the United States. My name was Panayotis Paraskeva Kulmandas.
And where were you born?
I was born on an island in the Aegean, just off the coast of Asia Minor. In ancient times, they called it Lesbos. Today, we call it Mytilene or Mytilene. I was born in a village on that island of about 5,000 people by the name of Agia Paraskevi.
When were you born?
I was born in 1897. On June 3rd, and I stayed there till May 1911. During that time, I attended the local school. I left just before graduation of the 8th grade, the highest grade of schooling we had in the village.
What, was it unusual for someone in your village to go to school that long, or was that the usual school?
We had, when I started, say in the first grade, there may have been 50 or maybe 75 children, not children, but boys, because the schools were separate. The sexes were separate in our schools. By the time we were to graduate from the 8th grade, there were, as I remember, only 6 of us. The rest of them had dropped out and gone to work either with their parents. That's the only thing, that either that or migrated. There was no industry whatever in the village, at least in the village. All the work was agricultural work, and not too much of that.
What occupation did your father have?
My father was a shoemaker, but after he got married and I was born, he couldn't make a living in the village, and so he migrated first to one place, then another. He went to Smyrna for a while, then he went to Constantinople for a while, he went to Egypt for a while, he went to Athens. Before he went anywhere else, he went to Athens because he had his leg broken by a kick of a mule, and he had to go to Athens to take care of the leg. While he was in Athens, he roomed with another boy from our village that was attending the University of Athens and eventually became the principal of our schools in the village. While he was rooming with him, my father learned to read and write under instruction of this University of Athens student. After he returned to the village and learned the trade of making shoes, he realized that he couldn't make a living there. He traveled to the places that I mentioned, and eventually he made 2 trips to the United States. He left home and he stayed in the United States for about a year, maybe a little longer, It must have been about 1906 or 7. Maybe it was a little later than that. Perhaps it was 1908 and 10. And there was a depression in the United States at the time. And since he had no work, rather than spend what savings he had by himself, he came back home to enjoy it with his family. Then, when the depression eased, before that he went to Egypt to make a living, and from Egypt he came back to the United States and settled in Reading, Pennsylvania.
When you were in Greece, can you describe some of the conditions that you remember?
My memory takes me back to the life in my family. I should have said that my father went to all the places outside of the village, outside of the island even, to make a living. He would return after a little while, and every time he came home, the next year my mother would have another baby. Until finally there were 5 girls and 2 boys that survived. There were other births that died in childhood or even in a childbirth or even abortions. We had only one piece of property, an olive grove that my father had inherited from his father.
Did your father, rather, did your grandfather grow olives for a living?
My grandfather, that is my father's father, was a tailor. And he became quite affluent in that business. He had quite a bit of property. All property, of course, all wealth was in properties. When he died, in his late years, he became an alcoholic and squandered all that he had. This piece of property was the only thing that came to my father. At least we got our olive oil out of that piece of property. Olives and olive oil. Outside of that, it was a pretty difficult time. Most of the people were poor. And a good many of them migrated, most of them for financial reasons, for economic reasons, and others because of racial, political reasons. We were minority Greeks living in Turkey. And although most of the population of the island were Greeks, still we were under the domination of the Turks, and we didn't have the privileges that free men would have and can have. The schooling was very poor. We had 8 grades and only 4 teachers for the 8 grades. Four teachers for 8 grades. The 6th, 7th, and 8th grades were taken care of by the principal of the school system and an added teacher. Compared to the schooling in the United States today, it's incomparable. In the winter, we had to we could go to school, but they wouldn't let us in unless we brought something to keep the school warm. We had to bring either a log or some kindling or even matches to start the fire. There was a big stove in the middle that try to heat the building. The living, even in food conditions, was questionable. I remember my mother being by herself, her husband and my father miles, hundreds and sometimes thousands of miles away. She had to make ends meet the best she knew how. I remember mornings where we would get up, we had a table, we didn't have chairs in the kitchen. We owned the home. In fact, no girl could get married unless she had a home and well furnished. But the furnishings were very crude. We had seats built in along the wall of the kitchen, and we had a table that would stand up from the floor about, I would say, a foot, not more than 12 inches. And the whole family sat around that table and they ate out of the same dish. In the morning, I started to say, she had a bowl and she filled it with water, poured some olive oil on top of it, which of course floated, added some salt, and we dipped our bread in that and ate it. That was our breakfast, and then went to school. As far as the sleeping was concerned, there was a fireplace. The only place of warmth in the house was the fireplace. And while the fireplace was burning during the day and kept the kitchen fairly warm, we slept on the floor of the kitchen. We had no beds. Mother had mattresses rolled up and stored away in a large cabinet in the kitchen. And then at night she would unroll it on the floor, and we slept. When Dad was home, 9 of us. When he was away, 8 of us. And we slept like sardines. One head would be one side, the other head would be on the other side, and so on. But we kept warm that way. The fire soon went out and the cold set in. But we survived. All 7 of us survived to go to school and get at least a semblance of education.
Did the Greek Orthodox Church play a very big role?
The schools were... The Turks had nothing to do with our schooling, with our education, or with any of our domestic affairs. That was all in the hands of the Greek Orthodox Catholic Church. And while they had control of the schools, our schooling was very meager. There were some things that the Turks would not allow us to study. They wouldn't allow us to study the Byzantine history. The history of the Byzantine Empire, which empire they defeated and took over, sometime in 1400. And while we had very little interference, yet taxation, they would send to their Turks come to the village to collect their taxes. We had a policeman, a Turk. They made us feel that we were a subject people in many ways. A person, for instance, couldn't go to gather to harvest his olives or his grapes or whatever he had planted without having a permit, and the permit was issued by the payment of a certain amount. I forget now how much it would be. And that's the way we live. There were times when the citizenry would be almost pushed to rebellion by the abuses, but nothing like that happened. 1908, Turkey adopted the constitution. Up to that time, we were not conscripted in the Turkish army. We paid a tax to keep out of it. But in 1908, when they adopted the constitution and the Turkish government, instead of being an autocracy, became a constitutional government, and all the minority people of the empire were expected to serve in their armed forces. Then most of our youth scattered all over the world to escape that. But the Catholic Church urged us not to flee away, but to stay, join their army, allow the conscription to take its effect, learn to use their guns, for we are going to use them against them later on in rebellion. That was the tenets on which we lived, and the hopes that were gendered in us for the future. After we left in May 1911, we crossed over. We had to catch the boat at Piraeus, the port city of Athens, and because the boat was late, I spent with about 8 or 10 other boys that were coming to the United States from the village. We stayed in hotels in Athens for those days, and it was the first time we visited the beautiful things that were once Greece, the Acropolis and some of the museums, the palace grounds. First time I saw an automobile, first time I saw an electric light, the first time I ever saw a trolley car, the first time I ever saw a telephone. While we had telegraph wires on the island, I never saw an instrument of any kind. I had seen one automobile in our village and one bicycle up to the time that I left. That was 1911.
Can you describe some conditions on the ship when you...
The trip was, we were on a boat that was a small boat, but longer than its width would allow today, and it was a very tossing trip. It went from one to the other. At times in the mess where we were eating, you had to hold on your plate, because if you didn't, it would slide over the other side and probably spill.
What class did you go?
Third class. In the steerage. The steerage was composed of, as I remember, three layers of cots. And in the morning, they would light sulfur candles in the steerage to force us on deck to clean the steerage and for us to get some fresh air. But the tossing of the ship was such that to be on deck was nauseating, and if you didn't have a good stomach, you'd lose everything you had in your own stomach, because so many others were losing theirs because of the tossing, because of sea sickness. I don't know that there were any deaths on the trip. It took us, as I remember it, 23 days to cross. There was very little to see. My mother had given me a piece of candle that was taken off the procession that was celebrating the church on Good Thursday evening. Ostensibly, we were taking the body of Jesus, who was crucified, and we're taking it. That was That was Thursday evening where he was crucified. It was Friday evening that we were taking the body for burial, and that was done by a procession through the village. And in that procession, the candles that were burning on west, what ostensibly was the hearse, I can't say that it was a hearse, but rather the coffin of the Lord, was decked with flowers and candles. The tradition was that anybody that had a piece of that candle and got into a storm, all he had to do was light the candle, throw it in the sea, in the ocean, and there would be a great calm. But in my case, it didn't work. And of course, with all those things helped to make me question the efficacy and the baselessness of tradition. We got to New York. If I remember right, it must have been about the 10th, around the 10th of June in 1911. And we landed on Ellis Island. We were placed on Ellis Island, and entering the filing through and identifying ourselves and the officials checking on us, we were sold a lunch that consisted of, I can't remember what was in it, I remember an orange, and I remember some kind of a sandwich, whether it was a hot, a frankfurter, or was just a hamburger, I don't remember. But they charged us exorbitant prices for whatever was in that lunch bag. Some of them were offered for sale, offered to buy the Brooklyn Bridge. And unless you were foolish enough to turn over your money, why, of course, those of us that had a little education, and having people here, we were warned what to look for and what to avoid. But we got by. I stayed in Ellis Island for 2 days, maybe 3 days, until my father came from Reading and picked me up and took
Reading,
me back.
Pennsylvania.
Reading, Pennsylvania.
And then
went back to Reading.
Could you describe the conditions in Reading?
Well, the conditions in Reading, my first impression of Reading was beautiful. We left Ellis Island and got on the Pennsylvania Railroad train to Allentown, and we stayed in Allentown overnight. I think we slept in the baggage room of the Pennsylvania Railroad station in Allentown. The next day we got on another train, and we traveled down from Allentown to Reading. We got off in Reading, I would suppose, about early in the morning, about 8, maybe 9 o'clock. And we walked up Penn Street, the Pennsylvania station, which is on Penn Street. We walked up Penn Street and passed to the second or third streets. They were numbered. After Fourth Street, everything was beautiful and just like the postcard that we used to get at home from the United States. Beautiful stores, a wide square, until we got to Sixth Street. At Sixth Street, we turned left and we walked up Sixth Street to Walnut. And at Walnut, we turned right. When we came to 7th Street, my disillusion began to set in. 7th Street was the bed of the Reading Railroad. It was kind of a sunken track. We had to walk over a bridge across 7th Street. Looking to the right was the railroad going down, crossing 10th Street, and then coming to the Franklin Street passenger station. On the left hand was a railroad yard. And beyond the railroad yard was the station proper, the passenger station. And in the railroad yard, shifters, railroad locomotive, with the pushing cars back and forth and arranging trains destined to go either to New York or Harrisburg or Pottsville or Philadelphia, either way. My on the corner at 7th and Walnut was a cigar factory. We walked across and past the cigar factory. It was a little alleyway there, and there were a few houses between that alleyway and the next half street, which was Poplar Street. We turned left on Poplar. There were a few houses on the right-hand side, or the east side of Poplar Street. On the west side, after we passed the houses in the backyards of the homes on Warner Street, was a lumber yard. Beyond the lumber yard was a scrap yard. And of course, both of them were adjacent to the railroad yard. On the right side of the street was a few houses, and then a row of houses. But before we got to the row, there was an opening with a railroad track, a siding, that connected the railroad yard to Ludens candy factory, where they make Ludens cough drops and other candies. We passed that, and my father turned into an alleyway between the two homes, the first and second.
Were they row houses?
Row houses. The one adjacent to the railroad siding was almost half a wall, because the other half was taken down when they tore the house next to it to make room for the railroad siding to Ludens. We got in, and it opened in two ways to the alleyway between the two houses, led to both yards with a wooden fence between them. There was a tap of water just inside this opening, and a door that opened into the kitchen. There was a big iron stove that burned wood or coal in the kitchen. That was the only heat in the house.
Did you have any running water in the house?
No running water in the house. The only running water was outside in the yard. There was no toilet in the house. There was an outbuilding. There was no bathroom in the house. And we stood in the kitchen, and Dad says, I guess we better get something to eat. And he reached in a closet or whatever, what do you call them?
Cupboards.
Cupboards, yeah. And pulled out a plate of beans and some bread. Meantime, I was looking around, and the place was in such shape that I asked my father, I said, Dad, is this where you live? He said, yes. Why? He said, and I started to cry. And I said, Dad, I want to go home if this is where you live. But that wasn't the worst of it. by evening, the man that lived in it, in the house.
How many men lived in the house?
Altogether, there were 18 in a six-room house.
How much did it cost to stay in this house?
The cost, that's the way they had to live or accomplish our dream, our vision in coming to the United States. At that time, most people that came to the United States came, at least the ones that I know, came here with the intention of staying here about 4 years and saving as much as they could and then returning home and enjoying it with their families. That was their intention. That was my father's intention. That was his intention for me. Only it didn't work out exactly that way. My father and I, and three brothers of my mother's, my uncles, and the husband of my mother's sister, and father and I occupied the main room, bedroom, in the house.
Were these rooms very large?
Not very large. No, the whole building wasn't very large. How the others slept in the what other rooms were available, I can't tell you. But we had two beds. I slept between my father and one of my uncles.
And, did you have a bed in Greece?
We had no bed. I told you that we slept on the floor in the kitchen. And then, by the time they all got back, the rent for the house was, as I remember it, was $11 a month. And that, of course, at the end of the month, we divided it among the 18 men that lived there, and that meant it came to about 75 cents apiece for rent for the month. And then for food, they took turns in cooking. My father, who was a good cook, his Sunday was reserved for him. And the Sunday dinner was usually my father's cooking and probably the most edible meal of the week. But when we purchased anything, say 10 pounds of meat, we had a book. We put in the book, Peter, 10 pounds of meat, $5 or whatever it was. The other fellow would do the same thing. At the end of the week, we would separate it, get a column, so much, so much, so much, so much, and sum it up. Then add everything up and then divide it again by 18. And each man would take his share into the pool. On Saturdays, we would take turns and taking baths in the kitchen in a wash tub. That was the conditions that I came to in the United States. For their entertainment, the only way to entertain themselves was to get drunk. On Saturday nights, they would get a barrel of beer and a couple of quarts of whiskey, cheap whiskey, and best the evening singing and so on and so forth. There were times they would go to the movies, or they would go in the summer, they would go to Cassonia Amusement Park. And that's the entertainment they had. As far as newsletters were concerned, they would buy the, excuse me, newspapers that were published in New York and in Greek. I spent it, you better stop it. the as winter came along, we were still living in the same place, and my father and my uncles took pity on me, and they bought a small coal stove and put it up in the bedroom to have some heat in the house, because, as I said, the wall being torn down when the adjacent house was torn down left some holes near the roof, near the ceiling, and snow would blow in. Of course, birds come in the summer, but snow in the winter. They lit the car, of course. The kind of coal that we used was anthracite. And the next, and while the room was kept fairly warm, the next morning, when my uncles began to get up to go to work, as they got up out of bed, they toppled over to the floor. And it was evidently fortunate that there were holes in the wall, because the carbon monoxide that was generated by the stove could escape. But of course, some of it was inhaled by all of us, and we were all deathly sick that day. But none of us suffered any serious results from it.
Once you told me about someone who had severe burns.
In the summer, when it was necessary or impossible to use the large coal stove for cooking and warmth, we had the gasoline stove, and I don't know just whether it was the first year or second year, but during the summer, while one of the men was using the stove and cooking, the thing exploded. And I took the man to the hospital. As I remember it, the homeopathic hospital on 6th Street. The man survived, but he was burned. Oh, his body, everything, the whole body was touched. How he survived, I don't know, but he did survive. But then, the next day, they bought another similar stove. That was the only time that they had an explosion of it. Such a of that kind.
Did you ever have any problems with discrimination or with police?
As far as discrimination is concerned, it's according to what you mean by discrimination. I lived in Reading, and I worked with American people up till 1918. From 1911 to 1918, not once was I invited or did I have access to an American home.
What was the occasion when you were finally invited to
That brings us to another part of my life. That brings us to my getting acquainted with what we are known today as Bible students. It was the second or third meeting that one of the Bible students, the Brother Warner, who had a large family, asked me, and another man from the same village, who was also a Bible student, to his home for dinner. The first time I stepped in an American home, and it made such an impression on my mind that I'll never forget it, and I'll never cease being grateful to Brother Warner for inviting me. The titles of WAP, Guinea, another, I don't know what you would call them, was common. We weren't welcome. But we lived. Most of the men that lived in that house and hundreds of others, they stayed under those conditions for the 4 or 5 years and returned only to die from different diseases they contracted while they were here. My father returned to Greece at the end of the First World War, 1918. After he left, I moved to a furnished room that I rented, and I've been away from that milieu ever since. One time, while I was working in a Hoosier mill, this is my second job. Maybe later I'll describe my first job, but the second job was working in a hosiery mill. And between the two jobs, I did attend school one term, from November to the end of the term. And they started me in the first grade. I was 14 years old at the time, and I jumped the second. And then attended the third, and I jumped the fourth, and I was graduated to the fifth grade at the end of the term, and I never been back to school since. Again, I am very grateful to the two teachers that taught the first grade, and the other taught the third grade. They did everything imaginable, everything possible to teach me the language. Of course, I was presumptuous and aggressive, and I wanted, whenever there was any reading, I wanted to do the reading, and the kids hated me because I'd done the reading, and I don't blame them for that. My father, and my father's ambition was to fulfill his obligations to his girls, to his daughters, which of course meant that he had to build 5 houses before the girls could get married. That was the reason he was here in the United States. That's the reason he brought me here, to help him accumulate enough money to build a house. And because he had that idea, then every penny was very precious to him. I could tell a lot of stories about my life with my father, but it won't help anybody. Only one perhaps would be interesting. One summer I wanted to go to Carsonia Park. And I told him, I said, "Dad, I want to go to the park today." And he consented. That was very good thing to do. So he got down in his pocket and got a dime and gave me a dime, which meant that 5 cents was to trolley fare to the park and 5 cents to come back. I looked at the dime and looked at him, and I was so mad I threw the dime on top of the roof. And he killed me. That's the way he was, and because of that, I decided to run away. So on a Friday afternoon, I got my pay. I think it amounted to $6 or $7. I went to the Pennsylvania station and bought a railroad ticket to New York. I got to New York. I didn't know what to do. I looked in the newspaper, the Greek paper, and I saw a job advertised in a butcher shop. So I went and applied for the job and got the job. I slept there, I stayed there just that one night. The next night I was out looking for another job. I can't tell you the reasons that why I left. They are unmentionable. I got a job then, that same day, the next day, shining shoes. And the owner of the parlor had a room where all his help were sleeping. I stayed there just for a little while, and I got paid for that week. Whatever tips I had accumulated, I went to the Grand Central Station and asked them, showed them my money and asked them, where can I get with this money? They told me you could get as far as New Haven. So I bought myself a ticket to New Haven and landed in New Haven. Went into New Haven station, and I knew nobody in New Haven. I had a few pennies in my pocket, and I sat there on the bench and worried as to what was I going to do next. There was a lady sitting across the aisle on another bench, and suddenly she got up and walked away. I noticed that she left her pocketbook there. So I took a jump and sat on the pocketbook, and I waited. She didn't come back. So I opened the pocketbook and I found, I think it was 90 cents. So I bought another ticket to Ansonia, Connecticut, from New Haven. In Ansonia, I knew people that were living there that come from the same village. So I went to Ansonia, and of course the people that I knew took me in, but then I started looking for a job. Most of the work available in Ansonia were in brass mills. And nobody would hire me because I wasn't big enough, or at least they never believed me that I was